Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first argument of the morning is Baskin versus Bogan. Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I have three principal points I'd like to make today. The first is that Baker v. Nelson still controls this question over whether the Constitution requires states to recognize and license same-sex marriages. The second is that the position put forth by the plaintiffs in this case admit of no limiting principle, so there is no, in the end, way to limit what they are claiming as a constitutional right. And third, that there are no grounds for inferring animus from Indiana's laws against gays and lesbians. First, with respect to Baker v. Nelson, a mere 5 years after the Supreme Court decided Loving versus Virginia, the Supreme Court...
Let me ask you a question, sure. Not about that case. So your argument is that the only governmental concern behind marriage in Indiana is accidental births, the unintended children. Now, isn't it true most unintended children are put up for adoption?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but...
Well, what do you think? What happens to the unintended children?
I think many times single mothers care for them. And I think part of what the strategy...
But let me ask you this. There are between 200,000 and 250,000 adopted children in the United States, of whom more than 3,000 live in Indiana. You think a number of them are put up for adoption? Do you think these adopted children come primarily from married couples or from unmarried parents?
Principally, I would guess, from unmarried.
Of course, unmarried, right. So now you have a huge number of potentially abandoned children, and they're put up for adoption. Don't you think it would help these children, the products of these accidental births, if their parents, whether same-sex or different-sex, were married?
Of course, the state is
now answer my question. Wouldn't the children want their parents to be married? So you permit homosexual couples to marry to adopt, right?
Yes.
So they adopt, and presumably probably a lot of this figure I gave about 200,000 to 250,000 is the number of children who have been adopted by homosexuals, including the 3,000 plus in Indiana. Wouldn't it be better for these adopted children if their same-sex parents were married?
Whether it would or not is
well,
not up to us.
Well, answer my question.
I don't know the answer.
Well,
it's up to the legislature.
Well, you don't know the answer. Well, let's think about the answer. Think back to when you were six. So suppose you come home, suppose you've been adopted by same-sex parents. You come home one day from school, and you say, you know, all the other kids in my class, they have a mom and a dad. I just have two dads or two moms. And, you know, well, what's that about? And suppose the parents say, well, you know, in our society, an adult can marry a person of the opposite sex or a person of the same sex. But, you know, it's marriage in both cases. So your classmates' kids, their parents are married, your parents are married. So there's nothing to worry about. Now contrast that with a situation where the parents say to the child, well, you know, we're your parents, but we're not allowed to be married. So it's just a difference. Now, which do you think is better for the psychological health, for the welfare of this child, to have the married same-sex couple or the unmarried?
Your Honor, I don't feel like it's my job to answer that question. That is for the Indiana legislature.
I'm asking you, do you have an opinion? Now, you
no,
may say, you
I do
know,
not.
It's a matter of indifference to you.
It's
now,
an,
it turns
no,
out, of course, that Indiana provides, and then the federal government is dragged along with it, very substantial, tangible benefits to a married couple. Now, don't the children of a married couple, whether same-sex or opposite-sex, don't they benefit?
Look.
The married parents are better off. They have all sorts of benefits, survivor benefits, spousal security, and tax exempt, all sorts of things in federal and state. Doesn't that make the kids better off?
Undoubtedly, but if I make
undoubtedly.
It,
now,
may
you're
I continue?
Saying, you're saying, yeah, I'm going to interrupt you, so you just have to be patient. But I'm not going to limit your time, okay?
Right.
So you have plenty of time. You are concerned with the unfortunate children produced by accidental births. I'm saying many of these are adopted by same-sex couples, and these children would be better off if their parents can marry. No? Isn't that obvious?
Well, if we're going to link marriage rights to parental rights, that does not limit it to two people. We have instances where there are more than two recognized parents. This is a possibility. And so what we're looking at here is...
What? Someone has three parents? Five
yes.
parents?
Yes. Yes, it happens. We cite cases in our briefs where the three people with parental rights have been recognized. So if parental rights...
This is worrying you or what?
I'm sorry?
This is worrying you?
Yes, it's worrying me.
The three parents?
No, in the sense that you have, if you have three parents, three people with parental rights... And if marriage rights follow parental rights, then we're looking at plural marriages. That's the point about there being no limiting principle to the plaintiff's
but
argument.
But lost me. If you have an if a couple if a married couple adopts a child, they're the only people who have parental rights.
Well, I think I'm addressing a different point, if I may. If parental rights trigger marriage rights, that in circumstances where more than two people may have parental rights, they would also have marriage rights among themselves. That's the logic of the view that parental rights and marriage rights follow hand in hand, go hand in hand. And the position that we're making, pointing out here, is that this is really about looking at the issue of what happens. How do we deal with the consequences of heterosexual intercourse, which don't occur with respect to same-sex couples, the consequence being babies.
And
the
Mr. Fisher, the three principal points you wanted to lead off with, of course, are your strongest points. And, of course, we want to ask you about your weak points.
Sure.
We'll ask the plaintiffs about those three points that you want to emphasize.
Fair enough.
Don't worry. The turn will come. But I'd like to follow up on this question about intent, intended pregnancies. You said in your brief that marriage attracts and then regulates couples whose sexual conduct may create children in order to ameliorate the burdens society ultimately bears when unintended children are not properly cared for. My question is, why is that interest limited to unintended children?
Well, it's only, I think, with respect to where does the legislature identify the issue. In other words...
Well, when we talk about intended pregnancies... When the CDC looks at that, they have ways of doing surveys and so on and asking typically the mother whether the pregnancy was intended at the time of conception. That may be a fleeting intent. Mm-hmm. I would think that the state's interest is equal regardless of whether the children are intended or unintended.
I think we have to look at it from the standpoint of, again, without if we don't have marriage, what is the issue we're dealing with? We're dealing with widespread heterosexual activity that creates babies. There has to be a mechanism to deal with that. The mechanism is let's channel potentially procreative couples into relationships that are durable and longstanding and will remain together for the sake of the child. Now, if it could be assumed that all parents would intentionally procreate, intentionally go about the process of becoming parents with that specific idea in mind, and otherwise,
people change their minds. I mean, the intent at the time of conception is fleeting and changeable, and the issues are the same. The issues of support, the kinds of issues that you've developed, are the same regardless of whether the child was intended or not.
I think the issue here is to deal with what may be a fleeting moment of passion that leads to a child that nobody contemplated. And how do we deal with that? And the idea with marriage is to channel that behavior into a specific institution.
You criminalize fornication?
I'm sorry, what?
You criminalize fornication?
No, no longer.
Would you like to?
I don't know. I mean, it's not an issue here. The legislature hasn't done that for some time.
It sounds like a way of dealing with this unintended child problem.
It's one thing to criminalize.
You don't seem to like adoption as a way of dealing with it.
That is not true. It's not that we don't like it, that we are grateful for adoption.
So why do you prefer heterosexual adoption to homosexual adoption?
We don't.
Of course you do. You give all sorts of benefits to the heterosexual adoptive parents and no benefits to the homosexual adoptive parents.
Well, no, this
you
is not...
You must have a reason for that.
Well, the benefits that you're talking about are not triggered based on sexuality. They're based, of course, on marital status, which
yes,
is...
Come on now. You're going in circles. The question is, why do you want the children who are adopted by same-sex couples, of whom there appear to be a couple hundred thousand, why do you want them to be worse off because they don't have these financial and psychological benefits of having married parents?
No, it's not a matter of wanting them to be worse off. It's a matter of what is the starting point for the marriage regulation system.
Why don't you want them to be as well off as children? You allow the homosexual couples to adopt. Why don't you want their children to have the same advantages as children adopted by heterosexual couples?
The question is, what can we do to nudge heterosexual couples who may produce children unintentionally to plan for this, to plan for the consequences and appreciate the consequences of sexual behavior? Those consequences don't arise with same-sex couples. It's not in the context of adoption that marriage
was crafted. But you're not answering my question. You've got millions of adopted children, and a lot of them, the 200,000 or more, are adopted by same-sex couples. Why don't you want their children to be as well off as the adopted children of heterosexual couples?
Of course we do. But may I continue? May
I children because their parents happen to be homosexual?
No, the marriage scheme is set up not with adoption in mind. It's set up with dealing with the consequences.
Well, that's a kind of weakness, isn't it?
Well, no. In fact, we're looking here at an institution that goes back to when, you know, there was a fundamental problem dealing with unintended babies.
Why does Indiana let sterile people marry?
I think the law goes as far as it reasonably can in defining defining marriage according to this theory of responsible procreation.
We don't allow incest, right?
We allow incest? We don't allow incest.
First cousin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Over 65. Yeah, I think there again, the assumption being that there would be infertility at that stage. Now,
I don't think you're going to answer Judge Posner's question. So let me see if I can put it a little differently. Wouldn't you agree that marriage is not just about having children, but about raising children? You agree there are two components?
Oh yes.
Okay. Then are you saying same-sex couples cannot successfully raise children?
Absolutely not.
Well, if Indiana's law is about successfully raising children and you agree same-sex couples can successfully raise children, why shouldn't the ban be lifted as to them?
I think the assumption is that with opposite-sex couples, there is very little thought given during the sexual act sometimes to whether babies may be a consequence.
So because gay and homosexual couples actually choose to be parents, choose to take on that obligation, that difference of choice is you're setting that up differently than accidental. So, I mean, here are people who actually want to have children, know they want to have children. It is not accidental. They make that commitment to raise the children. I just don't get that.
Well,
it's
another
aspect of what Judge Posner is raising.
And I think the working assumption there, Your Honor, is that in that circumstance, the state doesn't need to nudge those couples to stay together. There already is that working understanding. With opposite-sex couples, it may be a fleeting moment of passion that leads to a child. And that's what we're trying to address, trying to deal with the consequences.
Sure,
of
but you're forgetting everything else. Look, let me ask you. There are 400,000 kids in foster care in the United States, 10,000 in Indiana. Isn't there a strong interest in trying to trying to get them adopted? Isn't it much better for kids to be adopted?
Of course.
Yes, but if you allow same-sex marriage, you're going to have more adopters, right?
I don't know that that's true.
Well, it's much cheaper to adopt a child if you're married because you get all these benefits from the state and the federal government.
Look.
You should be wanting to enlist people in as adopters so you can minimize. What is pathetic? You got 10,000 foster care children in Indiana. Don't you want to get them adopted?
Of course, but you're now talking about.
What are you doing to get them adopted?
You're talking about prioritizing competing issues.
No,
and that's the legislature's job.
I don't see the
job.
Competing issue. What's
the legislature has an understanding of marriage that it has decided to preserve, and it's
but
based
it's
on.
It's arbitrary. It doesn't serve any public. I mean, you allow all these sterile people to get married. Why are you doing that if you're so concerned with. Procreation. Why are you letting them get married?
We couldn't constitutionally inquire of everybody.
Incestuous ones.
You can't constitutionally inquire of whether they intend to procreate.
Why don't you allow brothers and sisters to marry after they reach 65?
Sorry.
Why don't you let brothers and sisters marry after they reach 65?
Because I think that that is just, you know, too far transgression against social norms. Now, you know, if the idea that first cousins married, you know, is problematic. Well, I mean, think of it this way. First cousins being able to marry hasn't always and everywhere been a prohibition. It's the lines of consanguinity vary from state to state. There are policy choices being made there. Brothers and sisters, no. That's never been something that in the Anglo-American tradition that has been tolerated. So I think that there's a very big distinction between those two sets. Judge Hamilton, I'm sorry.
Mr. Fisher, you made an interesting point in your reply brief where you said that the same-sex marriage ban does not actually classify based on sexual orientation. And looking strictly at the text, that's exactly right, of course. But if we look strictly at the text, what the statute does is classify based on sex, correct?
I understand what you're saying. I don't agree with that as a legal principle, but I understand
we'll
the textual
take that
point.
Step at a time.
Yeah.
That it discriminates or classifies based on sex. Bob can marry Chris if Chris is a female. Bob cannot marry Chris if Chris is a male, right?
Right.
So that would seem to point us in the direction of heightened scrutiny, right?
No, I don't agree.
Okay, why not?
Because sex discrimination cases rely on, as the court in the VMI case put it, discriminations that close a door or deny an opportunity to one sex or the other. That's not what this is about. This is about treating men and women equally. It doesn't elevate one sex over the other.
Well, there are a couple of problems with that, it seems to me. The first is that the right to equal protection of the laws is an individual right. The second problem I have is that the argument that you're making is exactly the same argument that was made with respect to race in Loving against Virginia, and it was flatly rejected by the Supreme Court. The argument was made that neither race was discriminated against because both were prohibited and affected in exactly the same way. The Supreme Court rejected that argument, treating the classification as intolerable. So, if we follow that logic, it would seem to me we're in the realm of heightened scrutiny based on sex discrimination.
Again, I have to disagree because race and sex are not fungible concepts under equal protection. Race on its own is always a suspect class. And in fact, in Loving, there was overwhelming evidence given the history of anti-miscegenation laws and the prosecutorial context in many ways in which they were applied that we were talking there about an effort to maintain white supremacy, as was admitted even by the Virginia Supreme Court. Here, there's no suggestion that this is an effort to maintain the supremacy of one sex over the other.
Actually, there's a pretty well-developed. Go ahead.
We're at the history of persecution of homosexuals?
Yes, but I thought we were talking about men versus women.
We are.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
And we're talking about the linkage between sex stereotypes, and discrimination against homosexuals.
Uh-huh.
It's been developed in the scholarly literature, sociological, anthropological, and legal.
Right.
And that points, obviously, it has this element of sounding, some people say, like a lawyer's trick to say this is sex discrimination. But in fact, there's a deeper theory at work here that discrimination against homosexuals is, in fact, a reflection of sex role stereotypes.
Well, I think all this is a reflection of biology. It's simply that men and women make babies and same-sex couples do not.
But isn't the, I think you made a very telling statement when you Judge Posner asked you about brothers and sisters marrying, and you said a transgression against social norm. I mean, isn't that really your fundamental problem or concern?
No, I think
that the gay marriages really boil down to that.
No, I think that we're purely...
Particularly when you look at the history, as Judge Hamilton has pointed out, of the persecution of gay people in our society.
No, I think what we're talking about here is purely utilitarian. It's purely a matter of men and women make babies and same-sex couples do not. And we have to have a mechanism for dealing with those babies, and marriage is that mechanism. My red light is on. I don't know if you'd like me to keep going.
Indiana reaffirm its ban on same-sex marriage in 1997.
Was it 97?
Yeah,
we readopted.
Why'd you do that? Had the
I think it was probably
early one expired or something.
No. I think probably what happened was there was a reaction to the Hawaii case that was going through the courts, and there was a suggestion that perhaps Hawaii would recognize same-sex marriages. The legislature readopted the exact same definition.
Why was it readopted since it was an effective law? You didn't have Hawaii's law.
No, because it also added two things. It adopted the same definition, but then added a section saying that same-sex marriages were void in Indiana no matter where solemnized. And that was why it just reenacted the whole statute together with that added section.
Oh, the added section about non-recognition of the...
Right, exactly.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Fisher, if I could just pursue a couple of other matters briefly. Mr. Fisher, can you identify any other contexts of state law besides marriage where you believe that classifying people based upon their sexual orientation would serve legitimate state interests?
Well, first, I have to push back against the premise. You said other. I don't think this is that sort of circumstance. But if the question is, are there...
Well, then we get into the game, is it sex discrimination or sexual orientation discrimination? Surely the purpose here is clear. But let's get past that point,
right,
and please address the question.
No, I don't know of any other.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Did you have something else?
Just checking my notes. I'll let it go for now. Thanks.
Okay. Now, I'll give you more time, Mr. Fisher, after we hear from Ms. Taylor.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Camilla Taylor for Plaintiffs Appellees. And I'd like to begin by describing why our clients, Glenn and Henry, have decided to join this lawsuit.
We're familiar with the facts of the case and the reasons here. And Mr. Fisher wanted to talk about his strongest points. You want to talk about your strongest points. We want to probe the weak spots. Okay? You say you don't like the state's explanation of civil marriage as an institution that just simply uses carrots and sticks to induce heterosexual couples to bond for the sake of unintended children. So what do you think are the state's interests in civil marriage?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court has described a number of different purposes for marriage that may be different for different individuals. The Turner case lists a number of things like emotional support, public commitment, the ability to secure one's family, and a number of other things that may be different for each individual. But what is crucial is that the liberty guarantee of the Constitution protects for all of us the autonomy to make these decisions for ourselves.
Well, what exactly is the fundamental right that you advocate, and what are its elements? Let me be more specific. You're arguing that there is a federal constitutional right to marriage. And I'm wondering, what are the elements of that are indispensable as a matter of federal constitutional law? Permanence?
Absolutely.
Exclusivity, spousal support obligations, coverture, inheritance rights, property rights, romantic love, just two people? I mean, what's the federal constitutional definition of marriage?
Well, I'll give you two cases, Your Honor, that lay it out. The first is Roberts versus J.C.'s, where the court spoke of constitutional, quote, constraints on the state's power to control the selection of one's spouse. And then Hodgson versus
Minnesota.
Well,
that's an equal protection kind of theory, that if you have marriage, if the state creates marriage, you're familiar with the arguments Wisconsin is making here.
Absolutely.
That if the state creates marriage, then it has to comply with equal protection obligations. I understand that. But on your due process theory, I'm trying to understand what are the indispensable elements you find implied in the federal Constitution.
Well, the due process guarantee protects autonomy, our liberty to describe for ourselves how we will chart our lives and with whom we will marry and perhaps even build a family.
The state isn't prohibiting anybody from forming relationships with anybody. It's simply refusing to recognize one.
Well, the state is doing what
That's an equal protection issue. I don't see how it's a due process issue.
I think it's a due process issue because, Your Honor, the state is intruding on our individual liberty to choose with whom we will.
I have the same question as Judge Howe. Why isn't equal protection enough? I don't know. Discrimination violates equal protection unless it's justified. Why isn't that easier than getting into due process?
I think we went on both, Your Honor. The liberty guarantee specifically protects our ability to act autonomously. And in Lawrence, the court identified that
when you talk about fundamental rights, you get into a morass, right? You have a fundamental right to marry. How many people do you have a fundamental right to marry at one time?
Well, this case, Your Honor, no more predetermines the outcome of a polygamy challenge than
polygamy
Perez
in the Old Testament. I don't understand. Where do you draw the line? I don't.
Yeah, because I mean that's a big position your opponents make in terms of what are the limits in terms of how you define marriage. What are the boundaries? So, for example, should a state allow two adults that were friends, committed to living together, they owned property together, they raised each other's children, but they didn't have romantic involvement? Should they be allowed to marry? I mean, their point is there would be no limitation.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, in the context of a challenge to a polygamy ban or something like that, the state would assert a whole host of different governmental interests that are not at issue here. And there is no reason why that claim should prevail any more than we're seeing prevailing polygamy challenges after the 1948.
What is the objection of polygamy?
Sorry?
What is the objection of polygamy?
Well, the state may assert interests associated with the way that the law would have to change in order to accommodate multiple spouses.
The arguments against polygamy sound an awful lot like the arguments against gay marriage.
Well, nothing has to change about marriage, Your Honor, as we've seen in 19 states in the District of Columbia, except elimination of the gendered entry barrier.
The strongest argument against recognizing polygamy, then, is simply the challenge of rewriting the laws to deal with, for example, inheritance rules for multiple spouses instead of for just one?
Your Honor, that case would have to rise or fall on its own merits, and the state may assert something to do with that. However, here, the claim is identical with respect to the due process.
It would be a pretty weak argument against the kind of arguments for autonomy, emotional attachments, commitments, etc., that are exactly the arguments that you're making. And it's just a matter of legislative convenience. That would be a pretty weak argument.
Laws do survive strict scrutiny on occasion. And, in fact, this Court has, I think, upheld at least three times classifications that were race-conscious affirmative action classifications because they served a compelling governmental interest. And so it doesn't predetermine the issue. The reasons for protecting our liberty to choose whom we marry, I think, are outlined in the Turner case pretty comprehensively. They have to do with what marriage means as a timeless and universal matter for all of us. And that has to do with dedication and public support and commitment, but it also has to do with the way government provides benefits and protections. And specifically for Glenn and Henry, for example, who were licensed as foster parents, the state placed a child in their home. They came here because they want their child to be able to grow up understanding that his family is worth just as much as any other family. So by denying that couple the right to marry, the state has done exactly what was identified in Windsor as the harm of DOMA in denying marital respect to same-sex couples. It has not only demeaned the couple itself by refusing to allow them to make that choice for themselves, but it has also humiliated the children in these families, and it has deprived them of the ability to understand the integrity and the closeness of their own families, to quote Windsor.
I want to still get back to this whole, you know, marriage, in your view, is a fundamental right. And I still have some concerns about whether states, assuming we adopt your position, could ban marriages between, say, first cousins, or getting back to the whole polygamy question.
Well, the state would have to assert an to use the first cousin example that you gave, the state would have to assert a governmental interest that would be sufficient. And the state may well be able to do so. And there could be a host of different interests that would be at play there from the sole governmental interest that the state has asserted here, which is an interest in caring for the accidentally procreated children of different sex couples, an interest that is not served in any way by excluding same-sex couples from marriage. I see that my time is up. With thanks to the court,
okay.
We ask you
thank
to
you, Mr. Taylor.
Thank
Mr. Falk?
May it please the court. This is an equal protection case, but I'd also like to, if I could at the end, address the limiting principle issue. As far as equal protection is concerned, there is no relationship between this notion of encouraging responsible procreation and the challenge statute in Indiana's marriage laws. As the court has noted, Indiana law specifically allows persons to marry first cousins over the age of 65 solely because they cannot procreate. And all sorts of non-procreative and non-irresponsible procreators are allowed to marry under Indiana if they are of opposite sex. Justice Scalia in Lawrence noted in dissent that procreation is not a qualification for marriage. And even if there was some tenuous relationship, there is no explanation, nor is there possibly one apparent, as to how allowing same-sex couples to marry would in any way affect whatever interest the state has, particularly because the state allows hordes of opposite-sex people who are not procreating to marry. Ultimately, in their reply brief, the state seems to try and expand this notion of responsible procreation beyond the minute of procreation to raising children. But there, of course, as the court has noted out, we reach an even more obvious equal protection problem, because as far as the child is concerned, that child has the exact same needs and can have the exact same benefit and security from their parents being married, regardless of whether their parents are same sex or opposite sex. And of course, at its most basic.
Or whether the child was intended or not.
Of course. Most children don't grow up thinking, I was intended, I wasn't intended. And most parents tend not to think that way about their children, at least eventually. The point, of course.
Some families have complicated histories.
So. Well, of course they do. But the point is, if equal protection at its most basic, which of course it is that everyone who's equal should be treated equally. If you could draw a map, a diagram, a mathematical formula of a family, and plug in both parents and the children and the benefits and the support, you couldn't tell if that family was same-sex or opposite-sex. There's absolutely no difference. And really, to sort of flip over to the right to marriage, that's one of the lessons of Windsor. Windsor, of course, is not a right to marry case, but it recognizes that in those jurisdictions where marriage has been allowed between same-sex couples, the marriage is exactly the same. There's no difference, and that's the right to privacy. The right to privacy tells us, as the court noted in Lawrence with regard to sexual intimacy and in the marriage cases with regard to marriage, is that we don't look at who's entering into the marriage. You're not allowed to legislate based on characteristics or identity. It makes no difference if you're a racial couple, or if you're a prisoner, or if you owe back child support. We're not going to look at that. And the same way, we can't look at whether you are a same-sex or opposite-sex couple. And that brings us to this notion of limiting principles, the slippery slope. Well, there is no slippery slope. There are three things to say. Number one, the Supreme Court in Griswold said marriage is bilateral loyalty. In Eisenstadt, it's an association of two people. It's two people. And that we know that. We know that because when we look at this notion of privacy, we say, state, you cannot regulate based on characteristic or identity. You're black, you're white, you're a prisoner, you're same-sex. None of that, you can do that within the context of the right to marriage.
Somebody arguing for a right to polygamy either 100 years ago or 10 years from now,
yes,
would say simply wasn't at issue in Griswold or Eisenstadt. It was taken for granted.
Yes.
And the exactly the same interests on the plaintiff's side would be present in that case as are present here.
No, I would.
A desire to establish an intimate, long-lasting, stable relationship. It just happens to involve more than two people.
The lesson of Lawrence and the lesson of the marriage cases is that we cannot look behind and say we don't want those people to exercise a right of sexual intimacy, or we don't want those people to marry, because we're not going to allow those privacy interests to be regulated based on identity or characteristics. I would submit, and maybe the future will say I'm wrong, but I would submit that three people or four people, that's not characteristic, or that's not identity. And going back to my mathematical diagram of marriage, if you have two people in it, regardless of their sexes, the formula is going to look exactly the same. It's going to look like marriage. If you have three or four people, it's not going to look like marriage. And I don't think there is any slippery slope here. And no matter where how we define marriage today, if we feel we have to, again, I go back to Windsor. How would we define it? A same-sex marriage and an opposite-sex marriage is the same. It's the same thing.
And Mr. Falk, if I could shift directions a little bit.
Of course.
We didn't let Mr. Fisher tell us about Baker against Nelson yet.
Yes.
I have a pretty good idea what he was going to tell us, namely that precisely these claims were addressed squarely in the district court in that case. The Supreme Court dismissed the appeal for want of a substantial federal question. It's binding precedent on the merits.
Yes.
Even if the Supreme Court can discount it as a precedent, how could we?
Well, obviously, the law is that if there have been doctrinal developments, we do not have to regard that as precedent. At the time that Baker was decided, not only was there no notion of a due process right to sexual intimacy of same-sex persons, it was criminal in most jurisdictions. At the time of Baker, we did not have the development of equal protection jurisprudence allowing elevated scrutiny. We did not have Romer, which seemed to apply, or says it applied, rational basis scrutiny, but nevertheless struck down discrimination against same-sex persons. There has been a sea change.
Right. Why shouldn't we let the Supreme Court make that decision?
Well, I think the notion that a lower court has the ability to find that doctrinal developments have passed the law by is an invitation to lower courts to recognize the progress in the law. I don't think any of us have any illusion about the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court is eventually going to decide and hear and decide a marriage case. But in the meantime, as every single court that has faced the question has held, I think it's incumbent upon the lower courts to recognize that the arc of legal history, if not actual history, has long passed Baker by. This statute is unconstitutional. The district court was correct, and the district court should be affirmed. Thank you,
Mr. Falk. Mr. Fisher, I'll give you a couple of minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points I wanted to respond to. First of all, with respect to the state's purposes behind marriage, if it's not, as we have put forth, this idea of responsible procreation and child rearing, we still haven't heard an actual state interest. We've heard what it means to individuals, which, of course, is very important, but it's not sufficient to justify states licensing and intervention and regulation of marriage as a relationship. And I think that's a critical question for the court to address. With respect to Mr. Falk's description of what is part of identity, what is not part of identity, it seems to me, reading the briefs in these cases and much of the literature, and even the term different sex as opposed to opposite sex, I think what we see is an understanding that many different people have different ways that they describe themselves in terms of their sexual identity. And it may well be the case that there are those who would say that their sexual identity demands or puts them in the position where multiple spouses are justified and called for. So I think that too is an artificial distinction.
And so why don't you also tell us why we should disagree with the 11th District Court and Circuit Courts who have said that Baker is not dispositive here because there have been doctrinal developments in the law.
It's a fundamental misreading of Windsor, I'm afraid. And you have in Windsor the court going to great lengths to tell us that it's not deciding the questions that are in this case. In the very last or second-to-last sentence of the opinion, it says that its holding is limited
to... But you see, you're right about that, but the problem is that the adoptive parents who are a homosexual couple and the adoptive parents who are heterosexual, what is the difference from the standpoint of the child welfare? Apparently not, because you don't put any barriers. You allow joint adoption by a homosexual couple, so you must think they make reasonable parents, so why don't you want to give them the same benefits as other parents of adopted children?
Because the policy is formulated with an eye towards what's happening.
I want a reason. Why? What's the reason? Do you really think you get less extramarital sex or something by this rule?
Well,
evidence, right?
The policy is not
evidence. You're not dealing facts.
Policy is not formulated with an eye towards jumping in the middle of an understood and well-established relationship. It's formulated with the idea of we don't know what's going to happen with any particular couple, and with the idea that we know that opposite-sex couples...
Well, that's loving, right? Nobody knew how interracial marriage was going to work.
No, I'm talking about the production of babies here. I'm talking about we don't know which couples are going to reproduce and which not. All we know is that opposite-sex couples can you know, reproduce even if they don't intend to on the
heat
of the moment.
But you let all these sterile people marry.
But we don't know who they are. We don't know who they are, and we can't...
You know who the cousins, right?
We can't inquire...
It's ridiculous, if you don't mind my saying so, like, idea of these people models. So you have some 80-year-old cousins who've gotten married, and you say that's a model for family formation, will encourage young people to marry?
Well, I think that's part of it. And the other part...
That front, is there evidence about that model?
No, it's self-evident is the only
thing. I regard it as absurd. You say it's self-evident,
well,
right?
We have legislatures to make those kinds
of
decisions. Of course,
you haven't studied any of these issues, right?
No, Have you read
any of the briefs in the Wisconsin case?
Yes.
Did you read the amici curiae brief of the Family Equality Council?
I don't remember the subject of
Well, you don't remember. It has a great deal of rather harrowing information about the problems that are created for children and their parents in the case of same-sex couples not allowed to be married in Indiana or Wisconsin who have adopted children, how the children feel when they grow up and all the kind of horrible things. One of the moms dies, and because they're not married, the other one isn't notified. You know, kind of horrible stuff. If you haven't read this...
No, I've read it.
You don't remember it, or it didn't...
Well,
make
I knew,
any,
I do now, now that you...
make an impression. Didn't make an impression.
No, it made an impression. I just
made
didn't remember.
Made an impression. Okay. So what's the...
There were a lot of amicus briefs.
What's the countervailing? They tell all these bad stories about the misfortunes of the kids whose same-sex parents can't marry. And what's on the other side of the scale? What's outweighing these costs?
What we have is a matter of legislative policymaking with the idea that marriage is an institution specifically directed...
Is there some empirical basis for anything you have said?
The empirical basis that men and women create babies, and there has to be a social mechanism for dealing with them.
If I could just pursue one other matter. Mr. Fisher, I didn't see in your argument, in your briefs, an argument to the effect that allowing same-sex marriage would actually threaten traditional opposite-sex marriages. I understand your argument to be that same-sex marriage is simply not necessary to accomplish the state's purposes as you have framed them. I think I've got that right.
Right.
But I was interested in the amicus briefs filed by Professor Alvarez and Professor George, and I think Gerges and Anderson joined in that as well, which were trying to argue that recognizing same-sex marriage would actually harm opposite-sex marriages. Do you have a view on that you want to share?
Well, and I think it's correct that we don't think it's a necessary argument. I think that what they're getting at is this idea that if we fundamentally redefine marriage, we don't know what we're going to be left with. And we know what we have now. We don't know what a redefined marriage would ultimately be about.
So you think you can win without making that argument?
I do.
Though. Okay,
I do.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Fisher and Ms. Taylor and Mr. Falk. And we'll move on to our second case.